This is episode 6, Hazardous Times Ahead.
Hello and welcome again to another edition of Playing Games at Work. This is Michael Martin. I am coming to you from the office today in Research Triangle Park, and I'm very excited to be back again with our full complement of hosts. Let me pass the baton over to you, Andy.
Hi, Michael. Thanks. It's Andy Piper here, and I'm here in the UK, my second week in my new role in life, and doing lots of cloudy stuff, and it's been fun. So over to you, Mr. Michael Rowe.
Thank you, Andy. Michael Rowe here in beautiful Durham, North Carolina, and Andy, with all the clouds, hopefully it's no longer a fog. It has lifted up, and you are really enjoying the new role. I'm excited to see all the cool things that you've been doing lately.
Yep.
So I'd like to introduce we have a guest this week. Woo!
Yay!
Our special guest, I should say, this week, because I almost feel, given the number of shows we've done recently where only two of us have made it, I almost feel like we are guests in our own show. But our special guest this week is Chris Hazard from Hazardous Software. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
We are really glad to have you. You have a company that specializes in games and serious games, et cetera. And
coolest name ever.
The coolest name ever. Absolutely. And we have a whole series of questions that will get us talking for the next 30, 40 minutes or so. So I'm going to just let you maybe introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your company, and then we'll dive right in.
Sure. So I run Hazardous Software, and it's a fun name to have. Especially being called Dr. Hazard, it makes me sound very evil sometimes, I guess.
Do you have a freeze ray?
What was that?
Do you have a freeze ray?
Not yet. That's in development.
Okay, good.
Do you have a pinky ring?
No. We do have Preparation H, though.
Excellent.
We do a couple things. We do some games for we're working on some games for the consumer market, like Akron, which was our real-time strategy game where all players can travel through time. And we also do stuff for the serious gaming market, mostly in the level of strategy-level serious gaming. So a lot of other game companies out there will do games to train you how to do something, sort of low-level skill sets and things like that. Our focus is more on the strategy-level things. How do you make decisions? How do you do more aggregate tactical strategy level decisions? And how do you aggregate data? How do you work in uncertainty and those sorts of things? We also pull in a lot of the mathematics behind it. We're very math heavy and very empirically driven with our results, but also game theoretically driven. So we tend to pull in a lot of stuff from academia. We do both a bit of consulting and we're working on a bunch of products for the serious gaming market as well. Especially with regard to business process management, too.
Cool. So I mean, you're talking about serious games and stuff for working with businesses and mathematics. And I've just actually been this week, just slight aside, I've been at a Scala conference, which is a programming language based on top of Java. And it certainly felt like I was in the middle of a seriously scientific group of folks talking about high-level mathematics. So I'm kind of mathematics out this week. But what kind of games are you talking about when you talk about games to help businesses, and are there any specific type? I mean, you mentioned strategy there that you find effective.
Well, we're moving more towards the real-time strategy type games now. If you think of like a StarCraft or a Warcraft, in that direction, but not necessarily that. Think more like some of the sim games, like the SimCity, where you have a lot of different moving parts. What we're trying to do is make take the interesting parts of not just the interesting parts, but the parts that matter for your job, and pull those out into a simulator game and make that into something that is actually fun and engaging. And something that's also validated so that you can learn from it. So instead of having like an avatar where you walk around and you're walking around from cubicle to cubicle, we're moving and pushing more toward high level, more strategic views. So what sort of screens are you going to have? Instead of having a couple numbers on a screen or crunching through a spreadsheet, how can we visualize that data? How can we make it something that's engaging so that it is more like, not necessarily Tetris, but more like something that is that has abstractions to it, but is realistic and conveys what you're doing in your job. So if you're doing, for example, something supply chain management, maybe it makes sense for you to see all of the geospatial layout of where your factories are, where your routes are, all that sort of stuff. But sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you just need a more logical view of this flows into this, and here are the routes. And you don't need to necessarily see the distances. You can just sort of see the weights. So it's making those sort of decisions and pulling it towards more of a variety of types of games. Instead of there being everything being a first-person shooter where you go talk to people and you go walk through that, have it be more how do you allocate the resources? How do you deal with new threats that come in for cyber defense games? If any of you have seen some of there are a few cyber defense games out there where you lay out your network and you put various components in it, and you're looking at the network from a logical perspective, more of those types of games as well.
So more like the tower defense kind of things?
Yeah. I would say tower defense without as much of the leaning against the spatiality of it. So instead of walking through and you have this army of drones or whatever that are marching in to try to take over your base or destroy stuff or whatever you're trying to prevent in a tower defense game, it's more that these threats are coming in from different angles and not physical angles. More like they can affect different components in your network. They can affect different parts of your supply chain and things like that. So there's a lot of pattern matching in games. There's a lot of but we're trying to get it more not just the pattern where you see this and this is how you respond, because that's just a skills training thing. We want to have a lot of that stuff automated so that a player could say, well, if you see this, then do this. Really, really rudimentary programming, and allow people who aren't programmers, who don't think of programming at all, to be able to construct some really basic conditionals so that they can delegate some of their decisions and focus on the high-level task.
Makes a lot of sense. I guess, you know, as we think through of games that are helping businesses, are there any specific games that you're playing right now, either from a, quote, business perspective or for fun?
Yeah, I've been branching out a little bit more from my usual genres lately. I've been playing, I used to love Super Mario RPG way back when, and I've been playing, there's a new one for the DS called Bowser's Insides, kind of a Paper Mario sequel. I've also been playing, I finally tried survival horror games. I've never really played those before, so I'm trying Silent Hill Homecoming.
Ooh.
And I've also been trying, I used to play some shoot 'em ups and bullet hell games long, long, long time ago, and I've been playing a few more of those lately, like Castle Shikigami.
Hmm.
So those are the three I'd say that I'm playing at the moment.
And from those games, do you see any specific parallels on those, the game mechanics of the fun games that would apply to a specific business environment?
So one thing that I'm actually giving a talk at ECGC next week on information theory as it applies to game design. And I think that the bullet hell ones really gave me a new take on that. So let me just back up a second. So information theory is measuring the amount of surprisal. So if you think about a learning system, learning is all about surprise. If you encounter something and it doesn't surprise you, then there's no learning that's going on. You can learn stuff very quickly, like if you see you have an aha moment, that's a big surprise in a short amount of time. Or you can learn things that aren't very surprising, but you learn them cumulatively, excuse me, and you learn things over time as well. So, but it's still about the surprise. So information theory is basically the log of the expected log of the probability that something will happen. If I tell you that the sun will rise tomorrow, you're like, okay, you didn't really give me much information. You gave me a tiny fraction of a bit of information. Versus if I tell you the sun won't rise tomorrow and it really doesn't, then I'm giving you quite a bit of information because it's very different than what you expected. So that principle is used in a lot of, it's part of the foundation of communication. How do you figure out how to encode things? How do you figure out how to compress things? How do you figure out how to deal with signal processing? Well, it also turns out that it's very useful for game design because it's a measure of ambiguity. So think about, there's a bullet hell game called Ikaruga, where you can have a ship in two modes. You're either white or you're black. And there's all these bullets that are coming at you. If you're white, any white bullets will fill you up. If you're black, any black bullets will fill you up. And the other color will harm you. You have to dodge those.
Oh, cool. So it's kind of healing potions, healing potions versus damage potions flying at you.
So to the white ships, do they shoot white bullets or black bullets?
Yeah, you can kind of tell what's coming up. So if you have the whole screen is white bullets, then you want to be white, so you can use that as healing, and it's easy. But if you were black, then it'd be very difficult.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so the game gets interesting when you get all sorts of different things going on at the same time. So what's interesting about that is, if you think about it from a path planning perspective, so path planning is a hard problem. There's lots of algorithms out there that solve it for routing, for just moving robots around, for all that sort of stuff, supply chain, chain type stuff.
Yeah, optimization, sure.
You're doing that in real time, and it adds another dimensionality to the problem space. So now we can measure that in terms of there's more ambiguity in the game, and you can apply, here are the paths that the bullets are taking, and if you're moving your ship around, if you move it a little bit in any direction, you're okay. You move it a little bit further to the left, and you're going to hit a bullet. You move it a little further to the right, you're going to hit a bullet. And there's ways that you can measure the amount of information and the ambiguity of the game, and really the difficulty of the game, based on the degrees of freedom that the player can make before they lose, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But adding that extra bit of flipping back and forth increases the ambiguity and also the strategy space a bit. So if that game, even though it's quite unrelated to business process stuff, gave me another way of looking at information, how you can measure it in those sorts of games. So if you think about take a supply chain game, for example. And so, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I'm just getting drawn by some of the thoughts you're throwing in here, Chris. So a couple of thoughts, actually, if you don't mind me just quickly interrupting, because I think they follow on. One was, since the last time we spoke to you, you know, the platforms that are around us have changed, and you've certainly mentioned things like the DS and so on. We've got touchscreens, we've got more immersive 3D environments, and certainly what you're touching on at the moment, you know, in terms of, you know, directional, spatial kind of techniques. Are there particular hardware platforms that you, or hardware or device kind of trends that you're seeing that are impacting our ability to use these kind of things within a business in context?
Well, I think actually the opposite is happening. I feel like so many devices are getting capable of doing so much more with respect to gaming that it's starting to matter a little bit less.
Okay.
Personally, I have a very traditional software background, and so I'm used to having access to the hardware, dealing with OpenGL or DirectX, having really fast, powerful debugging environments and things like that. And so I've always been a little bit resistant to some of the web technologies like JavaScript. It's great in a lot of things, but it doesn't have the richness of debugging capabilities, the richness of graphic capabilities that traditionally that you could do with C, or if you did platform dependent code. Now, a lot of the web technologies are finally starting to get some of those things. So you can develop games for handhelds that are much, much, much richer than ever before. So you don't need to worry about that. And when you're thinking about strategy level serious games, it's not so much about the 3D, because there's it's not generally as important. If you're thinking, I'm doing logistics, I'm doing business process in a hospital, for example, you don't need to see the beds in 3D. It adds no value to the game. It's actually a distraction, because you're an administrator. You're not walking around and doing that, looking at beds and looking at people all the time. You're thinking about what are the strategies we should do, what are the and how will that impact the whole hospital. So if you just render them as 2D graphics, now you can do that on a mobile device. I will say, though, because of all of the advances in cloud computing and things like that, we now, and especially with mobile devices being connected all the time or most of the time, if you have something that is beyond the capabilities of your mobile CPU, you can just push it back out to the cloud, do a couple round trips, and strategy level serious games, you don't need that. You can tolerate 100 millisecond delay between your action and the response. So it's really, it's becoming much easier to develop for a variety of platforms, and there's just more capabilities around.
Yeah, no, that's actually a really interesting perspective. I was wondering, I mean, I'm a 3DS player, and I'm also heavily into my Xbox, especially with the kind of online aspect. So, you're right. That's a really, really good point. It's, you know, with as you say, with the expanding capabilities of the cloud and the you know, not that you want your local device to be some kind of dumb terminal, but you do have the ability to do much more sophisticated distribution of workload these days, I guess. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, and Andy, one thing that popped in my mind as Chris, as you were describing that, is almost the good enough nature of technology now. It used to be that you really wanted specific hardware to address specific capabilities in a game, but everything has become, the good enough level has become so high across all these different hardware platforms or language platforms or infrastructure platforms that the focus can go back on the gameplay, the learning aspect, the experience aspect, and not focus on, well, if I'm going to do the hospital example, I've got to have, you know, this kind of processor and this kind of memory and use this kind of language. I can do it, you know, in HTML5, I can do it in Java, I can do it in C, I can do it in C++, I can do it in whatever is appropriate for my skill set, but still give the rich, engaging experience for the game.
And related to that too, Chris, you said something I really liked about the managing surprise as part of learning. And you often hear the words surprise and delight used together. Do you have any feelings or thoughts about how to insert the delight part to the surprise to really make the thing sticky?
Well, I think part of that comes to the delight comes from building a mental model that can predict and is useful in something that you find engaging. So you put all those together, and that's when it becomes that delight. I guess I'm sort of in a interesting and funny position in that my background is with respect to game theory and the mathematics of strategy. So I used to joke that I was a machine or rational agent psychologist. And so when
a computer whisperer.
Exactly. So ascribing a lot of the computational aspects and rational agent aspects to humans, gets me into trouble sometimes when I argue with sociologists, which I have done. And I mean like research sociologists, but I tend to view people as more rational than I think most people think. And my argument is that, you think you have crazy people doing crazy things. You have people who are very emotive and you say, well, that's not rational. Well, it depends on what your valuations are. In a lot of my research work, I was looking at decoupling the valuations, which mean your preferences, your goals, how you order all the outcomes of the world, how you desire them. And emotions can affect your valuations, your level of patience, and things like that. So if you look at, I don't know, some attacker, some terrorist or something like that, and you say, well, that's not rational. Why did he commit suicide? Well, if he believed something about the afterlife, that he would get set, whatever rewards for destroying something, he could maximize the likelihood of that goal. And if you build and start looking at everything as rational agents, even if they have crazy goals, even if they're doing things that don't make any sense or very emotive, you can still build models around those sort of things. So that tends to be my philosophy. So looking at teaching and learning and from an information theory perspective, I mentioned before about how you can apply it to those simple games. We'll now start applying it to more strategy level games and say, what are the different possibilities you can make? What are the different decisions you can make and how do they impact the world? Many simulators have lots in business have a lot of different sensitive parameters, and you do sensitivity analysis and say, well, in this space of the problem, when we have a very competitive market, these parameters tend to do this a little bit. But in a more expanding market, where we can concentrate on value as opposed to reducing costs, the parameters act like this, which is a little bit different. Well, a lot of times, sometimes the simulations can be noisy, but when they're not noisy and you can figure out, here is the model, here is what happens, and the people go, aha, now I understand this parameter, which I didn't before, and I can see how it will impact my business. I can see how it will impact my job. So measuring the game mechanics from an information theory perspective, you can start to see where those surprises will occur. And then also design the game to
to maximize the impact of when they happen, I'm sure, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I really like the notion. I hadn't thought about that before. But you're right. Surprise, unexpected requires you to jolt your mind to wrap it around something brand new and say, I've learned something from that experience. Ideally, either to repeat it or avoid it.
Very cool.
All right. So Chris, the question I was really eager to ask you, Michael and I were talking about this over lunch yesterday, is we're trying to think about what the most impactful game capabilities are for business purposes. And given the way that you've embodied time manipulation, you know, and the ripples of time being able to go back or forward in time, what innovative ways are you seeing or proposing time manipulation being used by businesses? And then what other, you know, most impactful game capabilities are you seeing for business purposes in supply chain or other places?
Well, I think time manipulation is a core part of what gaming actually is. If you look at the original Super Mario Brothers, you jump around, you die, you fall off a cliff and you die. You start over at the beginning of the level. That was basically redoing. You're undoing. You're going back in time again and having the ability to try a new strategy, to try a new attempt at whatever you were doing. And what time manipulation does is it lowers the risk. It lowers the, you can try things and you can experiment more easily. So I think that that in the real world, most of the time you make a decision, that's what sticks.
Right.
Especially when you commit it. So in that's really one of the main differences between gaming and reality.
You get to die once in reality.
Right. Unless you're playing a one of those games called like
paintball.
There's like people who play WoW that try to take a character all the way to, you know, max level without ever dying.
Oh, hardcore
mode. Yeah.
Yeah. Or are those the cave story like games? You know what I'm talking about?
Like adventure Zork.
No, it's a type of game where it's all procedural content, and once you die, that entire world is gone. You can never play it again.
Ooh.
Oh, really? Yeah,
it's a genre of game that embraces death, embraces the idea of dying and never being able to visit that part of the game again. And I used to know this so well, and the genre name is escaping me right now. But if you look at Cave Story, that's a typical game in that genre.
Wow, so it really feels that, you know, those are high stakes gaming, but what you're saying is by its very nature, most games, because you can hit the, you know, insert quarter and go right back to the very beginning, or when you die, you are at a save point, can continue. That's all time manipulation, you know, right to begin with.
Right. So time manipulation is nothing new in gaming. It goes all the way back to the beginning. The things that we're proposing with time manipulation are the ability to do it quickly and easily. With Akron, all players can jump around the timeline freely, and you can lay out a strategy, your opponent can lay out their strategy, and you can see what your best response to their best response is. They can see what their best response to your best response to their best response was. You go back and forth a few times, and you really start blurring the line between hypothetical and committed. You get people to play at what are known as Nash equilibria, or close to them as long as it converges, without ever having to learn anything about game theory. They start really getting in the head of their opponent, really start thinking about what is the way that my opponent can maximally harm me and how can I prevent that?
Yeah, as soon as you started describing it, I immediately went back to my econ classes, right, in Nash Equilibriums. the whole game theory idea of, you know, what is the optimal solution to the game. And when we think of business environments and games, it's not, you know, always so simple, cut and dry Nash equilibrium. There are so many variables and attributes, which is what I hear is the ability here to play out all of those kind of almost instantaneously or over and over again and see how close you can get to an equitable solution to that challenge at that point in the game.
Well, with infinite compute power, that's the whole point. I mean, when you think about chess as a maybe very simple, you know, two-dimensional thing, you can play out all possible reactions to any potential move. And you could model to say, well, if in move 37 I were able to drop a pawn from the sky and, you know, place it one step away from being able to be transitioned to a queen – okay, if I were to do that, what would be all possible reactions from that as well?
Well, there's actually even one more aspect to that, right? It's chess says, or how chess is addressed in gaming right now, is from this point forward, what are all the possibilities? What this description, or what we just started talking about, and Chris, keep me honest here, is Yes, but what if I went back one move and changed it? So now I just added permutations before now.
And right, it's just simulation, isn't it? I mean, it's simulation. It's the same idea with simulating business processes, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I would think so. And Scrabble does the same thing, right? If you're playing Scrabble and you didn't pick the optimal move, the computer can tell you, well, here's what you should have done. But sorry, Chris, I didn't talk over you.
Oh, no worries. It is a lot. Business processes are just like chess in that regard, where you're playing out things. You're playing out all these different moves. What happens if you think about the chess example is you make a couple moves and you go, oh, I was not looking ahead. I was not looking ahead these four moves, and I just totally missed that. I should have done something differently. Well, if you have the ability to undo a bunch of times and jump back and say, okay, I really should have done this. That was a dumb move. You've learned from that mistake. And as long as that learning is generalizable, again, going back to the surprisal, is it a niche case? Is it only going to matter this one time? Or is it something you can apply to other games or to other aspects of the game, other parts of the game? Then that's something very powerful and very good.
Absolutely.
Cool. All right. So we kind of covered a couple of things that are good about time manipulation. You know, what are some of the other creative gaming elements that you're seeing around the supply chain games and others?
Oh, well, one other thing with time manipulation applying just beyond games is, let's say that in a network you have a fault. You have some sort of thing that goes out and it's starting to cause weird results, or some service goes out or something like that. Well, mm-hmm. If you apply time manipulation not just to the gaming aspect but to your organization, use things like reversible computing, well, then networks can recall messages and say, nope, I didn't send that one. Let's roll back and then roll forward again without the fault. We've corrected it. That ability is very powerful in terms of debugging. For example, we're working on Akron. If somebody saw that one bug, that behavior bug that happened once a month to one person, really rare, hard to reproduce, they'd save the game after they saw it, send it to us, and we'd jump back in time 5 seconds and see it. And that was immensely powerful for debugging.
That is incredibly cool. Because think about how many times that scenario happens in business.
Exactly. I've been a long proponent of reversible debugging, and I love it. But there's so few companies out there and so few products that actually do it. I feel like universities don't spend enough time on teaching debugging and the capabilities of that, or enough research into that. Because it's sort of like that dirty secret of programmers. Everybody wants to write code, but nobody wants to debug it.
Well, we can get
You actually don't need to debug it, because you know it's all so well documented, because all code is self-documenting.
Exactly.
And so as long as you can read the code, it's accurate.
Right.
That's what it told you. Told it was going to do, right?
Yeah.
So just changing direction slightly. Thinking about all of these kind of ideas, what about some of the kind of things that typically get thrown into the bucket labeled, that word which I really dislike, gamification? So the idea of things like, in the context of business-oriented games, leaderboards, reputation management, rewards. Do you see any of those really playing a part in these kind of scenario simulations?
Well, so I agree with you. I really don't like the word gamification. I like the idea of the word, but in practice, it means a certain set of things that really kind of suck when they're implemented by themselves. Like, here's a leaderboard. Here's the people who've done the best at this. Well, there is a I saw a talk by a guy, I'm trying to remember what his name was, who was doing a bunch of work in leaderboards and how they affect people socially. It was a talk at I think it was at MIGS or GDC or something like that, and he showed a Seinfeld clip where they were looking over this Pac-Man machine from the 1980s, and somebody's high score was still on there for 20 or 30 years. And when you have leaderboards like that, like if I go play, I don't know, pick any AAA really popular game that has a leaderboard, I look at the people who spend 60 to 70 hours a week playing those games, and I have no motivation. I'm never going to be able to reach those scores.
Right.
So,
but if they're regional, right? You know, if they're like high score in the last week, or high score in North Carolina,
or relevant to a social network, or relevant to some kind of grouping, yeah,
that's exactly where I was going. Mm. So that's exactly right. So if they're done smartly, I think they're very powerful, especially when you're dealing with a business case or with serious games. You want to have scenarios that you can use for training as well. You're exploring your strategy space. You're trying to figure out what you should do. You're learning about the model from the, you're learning about the simulation. But there's a new guy who just started in the strategy group. There's a new guy who started in this one role. Let's show him the organization. Let's show him what happens when something big and bad happens. Here's how we react to it. Maybe this new guy will think, why did you do this? Here's a better way to do it. Well, you also have to be careful, though, because there's an old saying that I like, all models are wrong, some are useful. So making sure that what you're teaching is actual reality, and the person isn't doing some edge case like they're doing a wall or a clipping bug or using something totally bizarre that's technically part of the game mechanics but is not reality. As long as you're managing that, people who make good scenarios, who say, oh, this is really fascinating, let me can this off, let me pull this real-world data, chunk it into something that other people can play, and if that's something that's really good, the person or the thing that they've created, that scenario, can have a reputation, and those sort of things can be very powerful and very useful for disseminating game information across the organization, or finding domain experts, finding subject matter experts within certain aspects of the game. So I think that they're very good if done well in a complementary fashion. But if you just say we're going to gamify this, we're going to take something that is not fun and if you're in a call center and we're going to say, okay, here's your metric, and we're going to make a game out of this by rewarding you or having a leaderboard or something like that, that is not so much a game as something that you have to evaluate in terms of incentives, in terms of the psychology behind what it's doing, but not so much a game.
Very cool. Yeah, you know, one of the things that drives me nuts, I think we all agree, is this whole the whole idea of when marketing buzz gets into something that's interesting, and people kind of glom on without understanding the value or the concepts or what's really going on with it. So I think the reason, you know, leaderboards have become popular is because they're popular. So everybody's going to throw a leaderboard into something without realizing the mechanics, the appropriate models, the appropriate processes that need to be in place to make it a valuable addition, other than, you know, here's a list of people. Just like badges, right? You know, badging is something that's come around on a lot of different gamification processes, is to badge things. And, you know, do I really need a badge that says, you know, I used a tool, right? If there's value in the information being communicated and learned from using the tool, maybe there's value in a badge. But for the most part, I think badging and leaderboards and things have their places and need to be addressed appropriately.
Another thing is, I think with a lot of these, people say, oh, well, I can write a leaderboard. Leaderboards are easy to make. I know everything there is to know about leaderboards. That happens quite frequently because it's popular, so many people do it badly. If you want a real leaderboard, or you want a real reputation system that measures certain things, it's a skill set. You want to look to use algorithms that, like, for example, eigenvector centrality methods or things like that. People generally don't have those sort of things until grad school. So unless you've been studying these sort of things, you're not even aware of the things that work and the things that don't work. So you just say, oh, well, you just make a leaderboard, and here's the high score. Or in, for example, the chemical engineering and mechanical engineering and a few other industries, they use something that's called the desirability index for aggregating different measures of goodness or different like KPIs. So if you have I don't know, let's say like for a hospital you have whatever your KPIs are, let's say number of good results, like patients who are in and out in the prescribed time for whatever they had. You have another one, which is the inverse of or the lack of bad cases where people contracted something from the hospital. Whatever your KPIs are, you can aggregate them using a geometric mean. So you multiply them all together. Nice thing about geometric means is that they are you can put all these different metrics together, even if they have nothing to do with each other. One is measured in days, one is measured in patients, one is measured in something else, and the units fall out. It doesn't matter what the scales are, and you get something, a meaningful total score for everything, as opposed to doing some sort of weighted or arithmetic mean. And the other nice thing about it is, it doesn't always land on the Pareto frontier, because you always, as much as possible, you want to make decisions in the Pareto frontier. If something dominates something else, if you can buy, if there's, you're looking at three cars, and two of them are exactly the same, but one is cheaper. The third one's very different, has a bigger engine, but it's more expensive, and doesn't have as much leg room and things like that. You want to make a decision between that and the other one, but one of the cars is dominated. So you're if they're identical, you're not going to look at the more expensive one. So narrowing down your decision space to those that are important. And those sort of desirability indices are pretty good, not perfect, but pretty good at pulling your space into things that are on the Pareto frontier. So using these sort of advanced mathematics is very powerful, but not everybody knows how to do that.
Cool. Chris, one other thing that Michael and Andy and I talked about was really around the design of games from a UI perspective or a usability perspective. And you know, we had a question, but I'm going to change it because I think what's more interesting is there an appropriate model or process for gaming the design? The actual interface. I mean, do you find specific things that make it more appropriate to improving the usability or the UI of a gaming experience? If that makes sense.
So I don't feel like there's a well-defined industry standard process yet. I think that it's still too, from my perspective at least, it's still too immature for that. My biggest question is some developer puts something in the screen and say, why is that on the screen? What actions am I going to take based on that? How does that influence my decisions? If you can't answer those, don't put it there. So really focusing on the difference between gaming and traditional modeling simulation, one of them is focusing on the human-centric decisions and not flooding the user with information. Sure, you might want to look at all the log data afterward and see all the things that happened, but what are those key factors that really affect you? A person, you know, if you think about number of chunks that a person can handle, it's usually about 7 to 9, depending on the person, depending on the context. And if you're presenting gobs and gobs of data and gobs of things to look at once, the person can't focus. So try to pick between 3 to 5 or 3 to 7 different things that they're trying to action about at the same time on the screen. Another thing is keeping in mind what the most important thing on the screen is. For example, there's a number of first-person shooters that you're always looking at the radar screen. You're always saying, well, where are the enemies around me? And you're kind of keeping a little bit eye on the fancy graphics where they spent all the money, but you're looking at that. If you look at a colleague of mine did some research on where people were looking at sports games and basketball games, if you you think, well, when people watch basketball, what are they watching on TV? You know, they might be watching the guys, whatever. When they're playing a game, they tend to look at the coach a lot, which is really surprising. Hmm. And so EA... spend a lot more money on developing good reactions and strategy behind what the coach is doing to try to signal things about the game to you. So it's figuring out what the users are going to focus on and directing them also to focus on things that are good. Because, for example, if it's not good for them to focus on the coach, if it's not doing any good, well, maybe just remove the coach entirely or get the player's eyes to focus on something a bit different.
Yeah, I know one of the key things that a couple of years ago when business was all up in arms and excited about using virtual worlds as a way of communicating more information, et cetera, was the ability that visual design elements can provide much, much more information about the experience, the inner environment, et cetera. And I think what was realized was, to some degree, almost an information overload that people got all wrapped up on, you know, what are their avatar looks like and not the process and the activity that's going on. So I think your statement about focus on the why things are there and don't overload the information makes a lot of sense from the ability to focus on what is, and I'll take it right back to games, what is the game, what is the learning experience you're trying to do, and what are the important elements that are relevant to that experience?
Well, people do this to themselves, though, Michael. I mean, you think about the HUDs that people would put together. They complicated their own user experience
as well. And we've seen examples of where, you know, like the windshield of the future might wind up being littered with, you know, hey, come in for a cheaper coffee here. Gas prices there are lower.
And here's your Twitter feed while driving here's down the Twitter road feed at 100 miles an hour.
Yeah, because people will do that. But Chris, you're really saying is you got to strip it away. I mean, that's why telephone numbers are seven digits, right? You want to strip it down to the lowest
to 10.
Things. Yeah.
In some of my talks on what is serious gaming, when I talk about those sort of things, I have one slide that I really like where it's a screenshot of Second Life where all of these avatars, like 10 or 20 of them or something like that, seated around a PowerPoint presentation.
And I probably could tell you a lot of examples where you could get that exact screenshot.
Right. And to me, I'm asking, what value does that provide over just using whatever sharing platform you use, if it's Skype or
GoToMeeting
or right, any of those, what value is that adding? You just had people you're distracting people. You're giving them more to look at, more to distract away from what they're supposed to be focusing on. And so I rail pretty hard against people who say that, well, let's just put everything in a virtual world and that'll make it all better. No, it really doesn't. You've just wasted money and people's time.
Yeah, absolutely. But you wasted their time in a very engaging, interactive way that allowed them to, you know, look at the design of the watch face that you have on your avatar.
Exactly.
you may have surprised them in that way.
Or that there's some folks who are so focused on the graphics, because if you look at AAA games today, you look at some of them, they've spent $50 million on up creating the game. And a lot of that goes into the art assets. Yeah. Or you look at, if you see ads for games on TV sometimes, you'll see maybe 5 seconds of gameplay or no gameplay at all. It's all the pre-rendered stuff. So people have these high bars. Oh, the game needs to look so good. You need to be able to see every pore on the person's face if you look close enough. Well, that's just a lot of all of that detail, all that graphic detail costs a lot of money. So if you're looking at, okay, let's deploy a serious game, let's make it something simple, something that we can have a few artists do as opposed to this massive team of artists, you can start evaluating getting your return on investment much earlier and actually getting a return on investment on the art assets as opposed to just sinking more and more money into something that doesn't matter.
So with that in mind, you know, the next question that we had for you was around mobility. And to my way of thinking, stripping down to the bare elements is such the critical thing when you've got a mobile screen that's so much smaller than a larger screen, whether it's a television-sized environment, laptop, you know, et cetera. To what extent would you think that designing for mobility and by that nature, then simplicity of conveying the information and the experience you're looking for is important to do for this from the start, or do you think that that's, you know, relevant and germane really to just mobile applications and there are other ones that aren't designed for that, so don't worry about it? Where do you fall on that spectrum?
I'm going to rotate your question 90 degrees and say that there are two types of applications out there for serious gaming and for a lot of things. Do you want the application to be accessible, or do you want it to make people productive? Those two questions are often at odds. A good example is, for example, the 3D modeler Blender, which was designed around making people productive, but it is such a high barrier to entry that people say, oh, I'm never going to be able to use this piece of software. And we've all seen software that's designed with one of those two in mind, but not the other. For example, you say, oh, well, I can send text messages on my phone so easy. I just do all this. But then when you're doing the touchscreen things, it's much slower than buttons. Or it's much slower than you know, different means of doing it. If you have what was that device in the early or mid 90s where you had the script that you wrote where it had all those stylized letters? Do you anyone remember that?
Yeah, the palms.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, graffiti.
Graffiti. Yes. Yes. So it was a faster way to do it, but then it had implications of actually that's a separate sort of interesting side note where people who did a lot of graffiti had problems writing later on.
I have that problem. I used to take notes in meetings on my Palm Pilot using graffiti. And when I went and took my exam for getting into grad school, you had to write out in script a full paragraph. and I struggled. It took me 15 minutes to write out the paragraph that was just copying down the "I will not cheat, I'm a good guy" paragraph, but I had completely forgotten how to write in longhand.
Wow.
Because of graffiti.
That's scary, Michael.
So that was sort of a side tangent, but really what it comes down to is mobile devices, especially with touchscreens, are, with one exception, good at making things very accessible. So if this is an app that you're going to show to your CEO and your CEO is going to use once or twice and that's it, or it'll be used by some VP or some other executive a couple times for evaluating something and then passed on to somebody else, or maybe it's going to be used by everybody in the organization but only once in their initial training or something like that, then you want to focus on accessibility. You want to have a few things on the screen at once. Then maybe mobile is a very good platform for that because it forces you to do that. If you throw somebody into, for example, EVE Online, who's only used to casual games, their jaw is going to hit the floor and they're going to go, "I don't know what I'm doing."
Absolutely. I mean, all the customization and the ship management and everything else. Wow.
Well, they're games I never start because I don't want the learning curve associated with them. It's like, okay, it can't be enough fun to get over all the, you know, the tutorials and all the complexities I got to deal
Absolutely.
With.
Absolutely. Like draw something. I mean, gosh, that's complex.
Hey, I've played that. I
Twice.
Like it. Well, as far as I know, it was your turn, but I guess it's come back to me and maybe I didn't have the alerts on. I don't know.
So the thing is if you're dealing with a serious game that is going to be used all the time, it's going to be used every day by some operators, by some guys in your strategy department, then maybe it's better to have not on the mobile platform, but on a full screen where they can learn to use a much richer and larger interface.
Mm-hmm.
And those sort of decisions have to come up at the beginning of who's your audience, how much are they going to be using it, and what are they going to be using it for? So I think that's a better question.
Maybe let's rotate it just a bit more. We're Rubik's cubing this one. As we're enabling business capabilities and we're trying to do it in a way that we can have APIs to those capabilities that might be expressed in a multitude of different ways. Maybe it's a both and, right? So you've got the broader capability on the big screen, but you do have a similar capability with a similar experience, but pared down on the smaller screen.
Right. And especially if you're in a business where people need to be out on the field all the time, you can't have them in front of big screens.
Right.
So you need to figure out how can we give that sort of experience and that sort of depth on a mobile device.
Well, my way of thinking, Chris, on this is that analytics, you know, which are for some tough to grab. I mean, many people go through, advanced educational degrees and might have one or two, if you're lucky, statistics classes over time. It's not just look at a pie chart and be able to make a business decision. The advanced analytics, the big data, the kinds of things we're seeing now really require more detailed insight. That detailed insight can come from an excellent, surprising, and delightful visualization of the data so that, you know, you can compensate for someone who might not have had, you know, 4 years worth of advanced statistics modeling and operational research. And you can do that with a good user interface. And to my way of thinking, mobile will force people to be thinking about how do you visualize that big data in a way that you go, aha, I'm sensing a trend. I'm seeing something happening. Now let's do something about it.
Right. And to your point about the surprise, people are very bad at assessing probability of things.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the things like the book, The Black Swan, about people who people generally underestimate big, bad things that happen or the frequency at which they happen.
Yep.
Or when you aggregate probabilities together, you say, well, this has this probability, this has this probability, we put them together. No, it's actually this. And by exposing people to that way of thinking much more often in mobile devices, they can start to reason about the analytics more often. Because if you look at some analytics, you say, well, this means this, and this means that. So I put them together, and that must mean something else. Yes, but maybe not all the time. And serious games can start putting those mental models in people so they can understand what is the meaning behind the analytics and how do they look in different characterizations of the environment, in different, different business scenarios?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Well, very cool. So, just as kind of a wrap up question, I know this has been amazing so far. I want to throw another curveball at you. And when we think of most serious games and most serious gaming in a business environment, it tends to be within the scope and domain of the organization itself. How do you see things like crowdsourcing factoring into this larger play from a business gaming perspective, and the ability to reach out outside of your organization, outside of your company, into the larger community for driving learning? And is that really what I will call corporate learning, or corporate intelligence, or marketing intelligence, or what other angles do you see coming in as it relates to crowdsourcing into the serious gaming aspect?
Well, I think that that needs to be it currently treated on a very, very case-by-case basis, because you have to be very, you have to be careful about what information you're sending out to the public. If you make a game about, you know, here's what our strategy group is doing, you make that into a game and you put that out there and say, oh, you know, world, help us out with our business strategy, and your competitors pick up that game and go, oh, that's exactly what they're doing, here's what we can do better. You have to think about all of those as well.
unless you can be really successful at hiding it. Right. So I'm thinking about something like Foldit as a good example. You'd mentioned earlier about, you know, changing some things into a Tetris-like solution. You can obfuscate almost what you're trying to do, and you might be able to pare it down into something smaller. And then you're using, you know, massive amounts of human brains to try to solve a problem. And if you can abstract it in a way, you might come up with novel solutions you can't get to with brute force compute.
Right. And I'm really excited about those sort of things. And I've always taken an interest in how you can transform problems from something that seemed not fun to something that is fun. And if you know anything about computer science, you know that there's a lot of equivalency between different types of problems. And most games that are interesting strategically are NP hard, or you know, the NP complete, NP hard space in terms of computability. You look at Sudoku; that's a, you know, good example when you have backtracking. But there's certain things that people tend to be, like you said, much better at certain in terms of pattern recognition and things like that. And also you can learn from and have your intelligence, your analytics, learn from the process that the people take. So maybe if people are exploring certain ways, you can not just measure what the results are, but you can measure how they go about achieving those results in the game. You can take all sorts of detailed logs and send it back to your servers. So there's a lot of richness that can be done there, but it's figuring out a couple things. If you make a serious game and you say, oh, the crowd is going to solve it for us, and you put it out there and you get 30 downloads, well, then that wasn't a very good use of your resources. People generally want one of a couple things. They want to feel good about what they're doing, or they want to have fun, or some combination thereof. So, Foldit. I played Foldit. I think it's a wonderful, amazing concept. But as a game, you know, it's only okay. I don't feel like there's enough depth to certain things. But the fact that it does such wonderful things makes up for the fact that it may not be the best game mechanic ever, but they couldn't make it, you know, they couldn't make it Super Mario Brothers because it's, well, you're folding proteins.
Yes.
So it's balancing those sort of things about the motivation, both from why am I doing this? Am I doing this to help corporate profits, or am I doing this for something, a greater good in the world?
Sorry, Chris. It goes back to, you know, the Maslow's needs, and you know, what is the fulfillment that the player is getting out of the game, right? Is it they're getting paid for it because it's part of their day job, so the fulfillment is, you know, it's part of my job, or is there some intrinsic value that they get at a personal level, at a gut level, or at, you know, a aspirational level that is driving them to enjoy it? And it kind of circles us all the way back to some of the very early comments about delight, and how do you make the game delightful, right? And all the mechanics from beginning to end that make it enjoyable, educational, learning experience, delightful, and addressing a personal need for the player of the game.
Right. So all we need to do is figure that out.
Yeah, I think there's an algorithm for that. You just need to, you know, run it through a simulation.
So, yeah,
42.
It depends on your industry too, and your the perceptions of your company, what you're doing, where you're going. If you're a pharmaceutical company, you're saying, well, here we came up with a neat way to make games that can crowdsource some drug design, and you're targeting, for example, some sort of cancer, a way to fight and kill the cancer and cure people. Well, then you probably get a lot more positive press. But if you're developing some drug that treats the symptoms of something that really doesn't matter, or people think, well, you're just going to, you know, all the arguments that are always railed against the pharmaceutical industry, and it's just going to not help you. Or supply chain logistics. Most people do not think about that industry very much who aren't in it. And it's sort of like the offensive line of a football team. You don't hear about them unless they're doing bad.
Right.
And so it's hard to make those sort of industries sexy. So then you need to make it into something. You really need to focus on the fun, because you're not going to get the intrinsic motivation if I'm helping the world, even though you could be helping the world tremendously with some sort of supply chain logistics game by saving fuel, by
reducing greenhouse gases, all kinds of stuff.
But people are, you have to sort of tailor it towards those sort of things.
Well, yeah. I mean, and you can imagine a brave new world where your job is to go play the game. It's like, oh, I got to go play this game again, right? Because what you've just described are things that businesses care about desperately, right? They invest heavily to reduce fuel costs and to streamline operations. So, you know, you could see where, you know, the gold farmers in World of Warcraft of the past could wind up being the, you know, supply chain game players of the future.
Right.
Well, Michael, this has been fantastic.
Yeah. Chris, thank you very much. You know, it's been fun and educational. We should game this podcast.
Well, we kind of do. It is a game.
It is a game. The game is who can interrupt who? No. Whose Skype connection will stay connected?
Well, and when we get our little endorphin and dopamine drips when this goes, you know, out into the wild world too. I mean, it's fun.
Absolutely.
So, Chris, thank you very, very, very much for spending some time with us.
Yeah, and Chris, you mentioned you're going to be speaking at the East Coast Gamers Conference in a week.
Yeah, next Tuesday.
You want to put an official plug? What's the name of your session?
Let me look that up.
It's awesome.
It's awesome session.
Yeah, that's when you know you're an academic, is when you have to look up your conference talks.
And just while you look that up, Chris, I'll put a plug in for a podcast that I'll be doing on April 30th. I will be a guest on the Wolf and Dulce Hour, which is a machinima podcast that focuses primarily on Real Illusion's iClone. And looking forward to that. Been a long time listener since they first started out, and that's going to be lots of fun too. So I'll game that one too. There's a great game that listeners to that show play, usually with scotch or vodka or beer.
Okay, so I just looked at my title. It's Information Conveyance and Surprisal: How Game Mechanics Communicate Strategic Choice to Players.
Nice and short. Love it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Drop the link in though. Let's make sure that we put that in the publication too.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think this show will come out right after the conference.
Oh,
because the conference is the 29th, right? 27th through 29th or something like that.
Next Tuesday and Wednesday. So yeah.
Well, 24th, 25th. We'll still put a link in there in case the East Coast Gamers Conference throws up any charts or downloads or for people to listen to it. Because I think, you know, just given what we've heard about on this show, I think there's going to be lots of fun to be heard and lots of learning for people if they can catch that.
Sounds good. Will either of you guys be at the at ECGC?
I was trying to schedule it, and unfortunately I am slammed. I'm very bummed. I had the honor of speaking at it a couple of years ago, and I think they have done a great job of building that conference into a showcase of gaming on the East Coast.
Yeah.
Which I know is their mission. This is I know we probably can't say this, but to me this is GDC East.
Yeah, it is. I've at the moment my calendar is pretty slammed too, but I'm working to free a couple of things up, and if I can manage to squeak out for a bit, I'm going to aim for your session, Chris.
Okay, mine is I think 11 o'clock on Tuesday, if I remember right.
Okay, cool. Now I'm looking at the website right now.
Excellent. Well, Chris, again, thank you very much. Sorry, Andy had to drop off about midway through the recording, but Andy.
He asked us to say thank you on his behalf too.
Yes, thank you. Great. And for everybody else, if you could drop us your comments, your emails, rate us on iTunes, follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz. We'd love to hear more from you. What are the topics that you want to hear coming up as we continue driving forward? Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Chris. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.